interview with Fox News, Trump is wooing Latino voters and earlier women in a Fox town hall.
I'm the father of IVF, so I want to hear this question.
Jimmy Carter has cast his ballot. The Carter Center says he voted by mail today. His son says he wanted to vote for Harris. President Biden delivered the eulogy at Ethel Kennedy's funeral today. One of three presidents attending the funeral, the widow of Robert F. Kennedy, died last week. CBS News Brief. I'm Cammie McCormick.
It's better over here. If you're 55 and up, T-Mobile has an exclusive rate plan just for you. Right now, get two lines of talk, text, and data for just $30 a line. That's a 45% savings versus Verizon and AT&T. Plus, you can get one of the latest 5G phones free when you add a line. That's right, a free 5G phone. Experience all this and more on America's largest 5G network. So why wait? At T-Mobile, customers 55 and up can get two lines of talk, text, and data for only $30 a line. Just go to T-Mobile.com/choice55 or visit your local store to make the switch.
With auto pay using debit or bank account, plus taxes and fees, 45% off two lines versus AT&T Starter and Verizon Welcome. Plan benefits vary. Free phones up to $300 off with 24 monthly bill credits and qualifying new line for well-qualified customers, plus tax and $35 device connection charge. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue remaining bill credits. Bill credits end if you pay off device early. See details at T-Mobile.com.
And now, Maine's best guest list, live from Bangor, this is Downtown with Rich Kimmel.
Oh yes, it's true. Hour two, 5 o'clock hour here on a Wednesday afternoon. Rich Kimmel with you along with Bruce Pratt. Downtown brought to you every day by Renewal by Anderson, your trusted window and door replacement expert of Greater Maine, offering free in-home consultation and celebrating their 10th anniversary. With a great deal for you, $299 off windows, $499 off doors, 10% off your entire purchase. Call 207-275-6622 or visit renewalbyanderson.com, the better way to a better window. Coming up in this hour of the program, we'll look at the sports headlines. We'll check out the weather forecast right through the weekend and beyond, warming up as the week goes on, and a beautiful weekend coming up for you here. We'll also have the good, the bad, and the ugly, a check of the calendar, the birthday list, and a look at the social media world on the grapevine. But up first this hour. Our next guest, a terrific writer and author who has just come out with a wonderful new oral history of The Big Lebowski entitled A Lot of Ins, A Lot of Outs, A Lot of What Have Yous. Happy to be joined by our friend Josh Karp. Josh, good afternoon to you.
Hey, Rich, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
I'm great.
Man, what a terrific piece on The Big Lebowski and you know, when we get to talk to people like you talk to, it just it makes the job not seem like a job. And you were telling me the Big Lebowski folks that you talked with could not have been nicer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was one of those, like, I can't believe I'm getting paid for this kind of jobs. They really, all of them, you know, John Goodman, Jeff Bridges, John Turturro, Sam Elliott and Tara Reid were all great people and some of the really the most fun people I've ever talked to. You know, all in different ways. My great achievement now in life, perhaps on my headstone, is that when Jeff Bridges and I ended our conversation, he just said, "Great hang, man." And I was, like,
"That's it. Thank you. Yep, I'm done."
I was like, yep, I can take that with me to my grave. I'm a happy man.
That is fantastic. Well, you know, we forget. Time blurs out some things, and reading the piece, and I forgot the fact that not only was it a critical failure, but a commercial one, too, when it first came out.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's really, you know, it's funny. A couple of years ago, I wrote a story about this crazy Dennis Hopper movie called The Last Movie, which was an abject failure. But one of the funny things was Dennis Hopper said, you know, he was interviewed and he said, you know, it's one of those movies that you really have to see four or five times to truly appreciate and understand it. And Lebowski, I think, is one of the few movies. In fact, I can't think of another. I mean, there are movies you see where, you know, you remember all the lines and you see Caddyshack, you see Diner, you see movies like that. And, it, you know, they become things that are part of you and you watch them over and over again. The Big Lebowski is funny the first time you see it. It literally gets better every time you watch it. At least I've never seen another movie like that. Every time I watch it, I'm like, I know what's coming. And I laugh harder every time.
Well, because it's packed with so much, too, that every time I watch it, and I don't know, I bet I've seen it 20 times now, but I feel like I always discover something new.
Yeah, oh, totally. And there's different things. Yeah, you know, everybody's so good in it. Like, even if just for Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance, it's worth it. I mean, that would be like the best performance in any other movie, even though he's only in it for about 7 minutes. You know, just the awkwardness of his laughter when Tara Reid propositions Jeff Bridges is like one of the funnier things, would be the funniest thing in most movies.
Well, so many interesting stories about the casting of the film, and you open this terrific piece with the story of Sam Elliott, who was excited to get a chance to work with the Coen brothers until he found out it was, kind of a Western.
Yeah. First of all, not to go on about the people who were in it, but I mean, he was an awesome interview and just a great guy and really smart and really funny and really very thoughtful. And he said, when you look like Sam Elliott and have a voice like Sam Elliott, you get cast as cowboys over and over and over again. And it was, you know, sometime, you know, mid-90s, and I think he was probably in his early 50s or something, and he was like, oh my God, he was making a Western in Texas, and he was like, man, you know, I am just being totally typecast as cowboys. I don't know if I'll ever break out of this. And his agent called and said, I've got a script for you from the Coen brothers. And he was like, yes, this is it. This is the absolute moment that this will be the role that will help me break out of this cowboy thing. And so he gets the script the next morning. They send it overnight. He goes back to his hotel and he opens it up. And it says, open California day. It says, a bunch of people singing the song Tumbling Tumbleweed. And they said, and a voice, a Western, cowboy voice, not unlike Sam Elliott. And the funny thing was that throughout the script, and he only appears a few times, they just wrote in describing the character, not unlike Sam Elliott, every time. And so so his first thought was like, he's like, oh, and I won't use, you told me not to drop the F-bomb.
Thank you.
he thought, oh, F, like, another cowboy movie. And then he just kept reading the script and he was like, oh my God, this is like the funniest thing I've ever read. And he also, one of my favorite things he said was, he talked about, how great it was to work with the Coen. And he said when he shot the final scene where he, had the conversation in the bowling alley with the dude, he did the scene about 15 times and he got really frustrated because he didn't know what he was doing wrong. He thought he was nailing it every time. And he finally kind of lost it. He's like, what do you guys want? What am I doing wrong? And one of the Coen said, oh, you nailed it the first time. We just love watching you do it.
I love that. And the characters are so great. The actors are so good. And I think, like a lot of people, I assumed that there was some improvisation in there. But what you found out in talking to everybody is that they stuck pretty much to the script, with the possible exception of John Turturro.
Right. Well, Turturro, I mean, I think, the one deviation from the script actually was when Jeff Bridges is with, the actual Big Lebowski. And he says, you're like human paraquat, man. And that was the one, improvisation. But Turturro, which I loved, he plays such an outrageous, character he plays, Jesus, the pedophile, you know, bowler with, you know, the long fingernail and all the weird, you know, accoutrement. And he said that when, you know, the Coens basically were like, they're like, you know, they knew him and they're like, he just, you know, he gets to the core of everything. He nails whatever he does. So when he got there, they were like, here's the character. They're like, you know, you, here are the lines, you put the character together. And so he was like, okay, I want to have one long fingernail in my pinky. I want to wear, you know, a hairnet, you know, all the weird stuff, his kind of like lurid ball cleaning moment, and just and all this outrageous stuff. And I, and my, one of my favorite things was he told me, he goes, you know, first of all, he said, like, those guys, he's like, it's like making your friends laugh in second grade. He's like, you just want to crack them up. But he said, I just threw all this outrageous stuff out there. He's like, and, you know, I figured they'd use, you know, a little bit of it. He goes, they used everything. You know, he's like, all this stuff, I figured, well, they'll never use that. He's like, and they just used everything.
We're talking with Josh Karp here on Downtown. His oral history of The Big Lebowski is out right now at Airmail. And fascinated to learn that Jeff Bridges was not the first guy the Coens had in mind for the Dude. I'm trying to picture Mel Gibson in that role.
Which, you know, and not that Mel Gibson doesn't have a sense of humor, but apparently they, you know, talked to him and he literally didn't get what was funny. You know, and there were other people, you know, for the one of those movies, you know, like, and casting The Big Lebowski himself is a good example. You know, one thing I found in writing about the making of movies is that a good movie makes sense. You know, like, you can put together a good movie, you can get a great cast, you can have a great script, you can have a great director, and you can make a good movie. But a great movie, a movie like, you know, The Big Lebowski or The Godfather, a lot of people would probably say I shouldn't put those in the same sentence, but they belong together. And those movies, something like really magical has to happen. Like, even things that seem, you know, when you don't get your first choice for a part, or, you know, something goes wrong, everything somehow magically falls right. And so their dream was to have Brando be the Big Lebowski.
Right.
and I loved, you know, there was a description of how the Coens would walk around their office imitating him as Don Corleone, uttering the Big Lebowski's line, you know, saying, I will not try to do Don Corleone, but, you know, condolences, the bum's lost. You know, and things like that. And then, you know, I think they offered it to Nicholson. They offered it to Anthony Hopkins. And then I think Gene Hackman as well. And then there were all these other, you know, totally.
Well, they were way outside the box, right? With some non-actors they considered.
Oh, yeah. Gore Vidal, Norman Schwarzkopf. I mean, they were like everywhere. I mean, they had this crazy list of other people, and I in a weird way, I can actually see Gore Vidal in that part. But they, you know, they hired David Huddleston, who was kind of this TV actor who was most, you know, probably most easily recognized from his role in Blazing Saddles.
Yeah, perfect, of course, in that.
Yes, and like, you know, everybody in that movie, you literally cannot imagine another person playing their part.
Well, and the magic of the Dude, a combination of Jeff Bridges, his wardrobe, much of which came from his own closet, or Brother Bose, and then right. The inspiration of a couple guys. Can you talk a little bit about the amalgamation of real-life folks like Pete Exline and Jeff the Dude Dowd and how they inspired the character?
Yeah, so, you know, there were... first there's Pete Exline, who is kind of the inspiration for both, partially for the Dude and partially for John Goodman's Walter Sobchak character. Pete Exline is a kind of Hollywood veteran. I believe a producer. I think he's worked at some studios, and he was the guy who told the Coens he had a rug that really tied the room together. And I think, you know, and what's great about them and what makes them, I think, different is, you know, they're just so idiosyncratic in what they like. And they just, that phrase, you know, and it's funny where things come from. I mean, that phrase really was like, they're like, okay, that's a piece of something we want to do. And then there's Jeff the Dude Dowd, who I talked to, who is a great guy and is, you know, I said to some in an interview, I was like, you know, he's a former hippie. And then I was like, he's not a former hippie. He remains a hippie. And there's the scene where the dude in the movie, you know, says something like, you know, I was a member of the Seattle Seven and I'm one of the authors of the original Port Huron Statement, not the second, you know, compromised version. And Jeff the Dude Dowd was indeed a member of the Seattle Seven and one of the authors of the Port Huron Statement. And he's kind of another movie industry veteran who is really dude-like. It's hard to even, you know, tell you how much, you know, he is kind of like the dude.
And was it Jeff Dowd or Pete Excellent? Which one was it that was in Vietnam and actually said, well, we were winning when I left?
That was also Pete Excellent, who is kind of this, you know, who is kind of a, you know, an embittered Vietnam veteran. He also, he and another Vietnam veteran were the, literally that story where they find the homework in the dude's car.
Yes.
With the kid's name on it. That really happened to them. And they went, they found it, you know, at this impound lot, like Pete Excellent's car. They found the homework. They tracked the kid down. And I've actually Googled the kid. He's a real kid. He's a real adult now. His name is Jake Freeman, if he's out there listening. Spelled J-A-I-K.
Of course.
And he they went to the guy's house, and there was, and they confronted him in his living room with his parents. And there was, I believe, like a grandfather in a hospital bed in the background throughout the entire experience.
There are so many great stories, and I love the music story of how they really wanted to use, at the end of the film, Townes Van Zandt's great version of the Rolling Stones' Dead Flowers, but it was owned by one of the most interesting guys in the music business for many years, Alan Klein.
Right, who had managed both the Beatles and the Stones, yes.
And he didn't want to let go of it unless they were willing to fork over $1 million, but they showed him the movie, gave him a screening of the film, and it was one scene that won him over.
Right, which is the scene where the dude is in the cab and he's had a rough day, and the cab driver has the radio on, and the dude does, he goes, oh man, he's like, can you know, I'm going to get the line wrong. He's like, can you, he's like, I've had a rough day. Can you please turn that off? I hate the effing Eagles, man. And yeah. And he was like, I hate the Eagles too. I'll give you the whole thing for free. So yeah.
Oh man. Well, it was so much fun to relive the movie through the eyes of the people who made it. And I was thinking back, you know, what is it about movies? Obviously, it's a combination of everything, but there were a couple of scenes in that movie that, for me, even on first viewing, where I said, okay, this is something different. This is one that's going to stay with me for a while. One was when they dispose of the ashes of Steve Buscemi's character. Which was just such a brilliant scene that, you know, just don't expect to see that. And it was so terrific.
Oh yeah. No, they, you know, like, you know, it's easy to be like, oh, they don't make movies like that anymore. But, you know, we really live in a world where, you know, unless a movie is going to, you know, make $80 billion on opening weekend, or it's a superhero movie or something like that, it doesn't get made. And what the Coens do and have done is something that only they kind of get away with, which is they just do what they want. And that is a perfect example of people, you know, filmmakers just doing what they want, and it's perfect.
And the other scene that just blew me away at the time and made me a fan for life was the dream sequence.
Oh, the dream sequences are a perfect example of just doing what you want, right? Like, I mean, who would even think of putting that scene in the middle of, you know, there's the two, there's one where he gets, you know, knocked out by those guys and he has, you know, the thing where he's flying on the carpet, I think.
And and then a little cameo by Saddam Hussein.
Right. And they just, you know, it's just so, and they pull things together so beautifully. I mean, you know, I had kind of forgotten that at the start of the film, he's in the grocery store and Bush is on TV saying this aggression will not stand.
Yes.
And then later he's, you know, he's like, this aggression will not stand, man. You know, so they just, everything in it just kind of, it's such a loose movie that everything in it is completely tied together at the same time.
Right. There's not a wasted line of dialogue in the entire film.
No, when, you know, talking about the improvisation, somebody, you know, I think Jeff Bridges told me, he said every, you know, F-bomb and every man was in exactly the right place in the script.
Well, check out Josh's terrific work at Airmail, and it's so good, an oral history of the Big Lebowski. You got a couple other things coming up, too. Can we talk about some of the other things you're working on?
Yeah, sure. I'm doing a piece on the making of Miami Vice.
Very cool.
Which has been really fun. You know, and that was, I in 1984 was a college freshman having the kind of hangover you can only have when you are 2 weeks into college, and sitting in my dorm room, flipping channels, and I just came upon the pilot for Miami Vice, which was just so stunningly different than everything I'd ever seen on television. So it's been really fun to write about that. And I'm actually just finishing up a review of Bill Zemi's biography of Johnny Carson, which he passed away last year, but he worked on for like 18 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those that almost achieved mythic status. You wondered if anybody would ever see it.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I mean, Bill got sick, you know, and like about, I mean, I think like, you know, maybe 8 years or 9 years after he started working on the book, but he was, I mean, I knew Bill very well. And he, he really, I mean, he was, you know, one of those people who really dove in to something and was an obsessive researcher. But in fact, there's a great thing in the introduction where they talk about how in 2016, he said, there's, you know, there's never enough, you can never do enough research. He said, but in this case, yes, you can do too much research. it was one of those books where, he just went so deep into it. And I think the deeper he got, the more he had written about, you know, people like Sinatra who, you know, lived very much, you know, on the surface, you know, he had a big life. And Carson's big life was primarily televised. He was a very, you know, kind of shy, person off screen, you know, somebody, I think Ed McMahon said something like, he's great in front of 10 million, but you put him at a cocktail party in front of 10 people and he's extremely awkward and he's standing in the corner doing magic tricks. So he really found somebody who had worked with Carson said, the Johnny Carson you see on TV is the top eighth of the iceberg that is Johnny Carson. and so he really, you know, and it's a fascinating book because, you know, really this guy, you know, was such a, you know, at a time when, you know, we live in a world where, you know, everybody's got a freaking talk show, right? On late night.
Right.
And he was it for, you know, for 20 plus years and on for 30 years. I mean, he was, you know, he and Walter Cronkite were America. You know, they were, you know, the most trusted, you know, universally respected kind of, you know, Carson, you know, they said like every night him showing up for work established order.
Yeah. absolutely.
The entire nation.
And it'll never be. It just can't be that way again because of the diversification of everything. They're all viewing is so splintered now. But to have that one guy that everybody watching television tuned into at night.
Right. And you know, and it was at a time when the culture was a collective culture where we were all having a common experience and nobody cared what kind of coffee you wanted because there was just coffee.
Right.
And now, you stand in line at any place that serves coffee and everybody's order is, 20 minutes long because they have all these special things they want. And, it was such a different world and, it wasn't suited towards the individual. It was suited towards the nation. And we were, we were all kind of one organism rather than 350 million or 400 million individuals. So it's been really interesting. And Carson, was a very difficult guy to know, despite the fact that we all knew him,
I'm such a Carson fan, and we've been in the extreme periphery of Carson with some guests. We had Bombastic Bushkin on the show several years ago, who told a great story about how he and Carson broke into his wife or soon to be ex-wife's apartment to get some things and nearly got arrested in the process. And then the comedian Tom Dreesen told us a great story about how Sinatra saved Carson's life when he and Ed, this is when they were in the days when they would leave the set and go out and drink most of the night away. And Carson grabbed this young woman in a miniskirt at a bar, and it turned out she was the girlfriend of one of the biggest mobsters in New York, who then was going to kill Carson and make it slow and painful, and Sinatra had to step in and save his life.
Oh, wow. Wow. I think years ago I heard something about that, but I didn't know all the details. That's fantastic. I imagine probably Jilly Rizzo was.
Jilly was a key part of it. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think the kicker of the story was that Sinatra had invited this mob, and I can't remember which mobster it was, but anyway, he had invited him and his mother backstage at a concert, and the mob boss said to Frank, you made my mom's life. If I can ever do a favor for you, whatever it is. And so Sinatra said, remember what you said to me. If you could do anything for me, this is the ask. I don't want you to kill Johnny Carson. And he goes, all right, I won't kill him, but we're through. That's it. We're even now.
No, that's fantastic.
Well, it's a wonderful piece on The Big Lebowski. It brings back so many great memories. People should check it out on airmail. We'll look forward to the work on Miami Vice and the new Carson biography as well. Hey, good hang, man.
Oh, great hang, Rick. Thank you.
Thanks as always, Josh. We'll catch you again soon.
Take care, man.
It's Josh Karp with us here on Downtown.